Let me just say, I think all in all, our convention has made a presentation to the people of this nation that surpasses anything that they heard, saw, or threw up on last week. And Mrs. Obama last night told the story as well as it can be told. And there is no question that when she talked about how she and her husband were trying to raise their daughters, that it was clear the difference between their candidate and ours. And I have, I don't want to say I go to the White House every day, but I have gone there quite a bit over the last 7 years, and I've only seen one of the daughters once. They, with great intentionality, make sure that their girls are not exposed to what's going on. And in spite of that, I had a colleague in the United States House of Representatives who dared to talk about how his daughters dressed in a very insulting and nasty way. I think the contrast is good, and it was necessary for her to tell that story. I also struggling. This is my fifth convention, and this is the first time I've ever been here without Dutch. Dutch Newman, and I think the query is probably the same with those of us who've been around for a couple of weeks. And I was just sitting over there, thinking about Dutch, who is phenomenal. I think that, you know, people need to be appreciated. I think people need to be appreciated, and so that couldn't be avoided with what I said. I'm not a native Missourian. I got there as soon as I could. I was born in Texas, just outside of downtown Dallas, probably 40-minute drive from the place where the tragedies took place a couple of weeks ago. And the first part of my life, I live in a shack. For those of you who've been to my office, either when I was mayor or in the House of Representatives in Washington, there's a huge picture that hangs on my wall of the house that my mother, father, three sisters, and I lived in until I was 7 years old, almost eight. And we didn't have windows. Well, we had windows. They were covered with wood to try to keep the cold out. And we had two rooms, a front room and then a side room where my sisters and I slept. My two youngest sisters slept in the same room, my mother and father. And we had... I didn't realize we were poor until some people told me. I think I was in probably the fourth, fifth grade before somebody told me. And I thought a normal childhood, my sisters and I. And because I came out of a family of ministers, I started preaching to my sisters. We used to have church in the little backyard we had next to the chicken pen. We had a chicken pen. And so I would preach to my three sisters. I stopped after a couple of years because the offerings were never good enough. And I realized that I had a bad congregation and I moved on. So, but my my the good news for me and for my seven first cousins was that our family, at least the men in our family, lived long lives. During my lifetime, I was able to see my great-great-grandfather, Frank Harrison Cleaver. I didn't recognize that when I saw him when I was a kid. And then his son, the Reverend Noah Albert Cleaver, who died at 103. And my wife and I have twins, and our twins sat on his knee on his 100th birthday to hear him recite Waterloo from memory, 47 stanzas. And he had memorized most of the New Testament. And then his son, Leroy Cleaver, my grandfather. And because you have the opportunity to have family members living a long time, the men at least, I know probably more about my family than most African Americans. And it always hurts me inside. I almost get sick enough to throw up. But we even know the people who owned us. Captain Henry Cleaver's wife was named Nancy. Had a son named John. And we took his name after Frank Harrison was set free, who I saw. And we moved into public housing after we got out of the shack. And I remember the first night we moved into the public housing, 405 B Bailey, apartment B. And my wife and my kids, I drive by there, they're tired of it. But I've taken them there. And I've also taken them to the shack, along with my sisters and their children. We went down to see the shack we lived in. But the first night, I spent probably an hour flushing the toilet. I just thought, boy, this is just amazing. This 21st century invention is just, man. And it was quite an experience. And we started school, and my sister, my oldest sister, Laris, this is a news story. It's a news story that was in the newspaper. First colored baby born in the Waxahachie Hospital. There was a little shack out in back where the black patients lived. And so my sister was born in that hospital. And but we had a story because my great-grandpa was white, so my Aunt April goes to visit him at the hospital. And she goes to the door. Now, all of my aunts and uncles look just like, and except my Aunt April had freckles. And she had more of the Negroid facial characteristics. So she goes to the hospital door. And so they said, what do you want in here? And she said, I came to see my papa. And they said, well, your papa's not here. He's probably in that house back in the back. And so she said, no, I'm coming to see my papa. Well, they picked the wrong one. My Aunt April is legendary in Lubbock, Texas, where she eventually lived. And my cousin, who's the mayor pro tem in Lubbock, tried to make it through without anybody knowing that that was his aunt. But so they picked the wrong one. They had 18 children, and this was the wrong one. My Aunt April gets ready to go off, and so my grandpa could hear the commotion, and so he runs out of the room holding the back of his little thingy, and you better leave my gal alone. Leave my gal alone. So the people are confused. They don't know what to do. So he goes up and she hangs it. Papa, I just came to see how you're doing. So just think about this in our country. They said to her, okay, we don't know what's going on here, but you can talk to him at the door. And so my grandpa, maybe was the best human being I've ever been around in my life. An amazing man. I just regret I didn't get a chance to spend more time with him. We moved to another little city, but we were poor. We were poor. We were so poor that our dog ran away to live at the Humane Society. I'm trying to, that's what I'm saying. But I was fortunate to have some fabulous parents. My father insisted that my mother start college. She started college when I was in the seventh grade, actually. And he said, whatever it takes. And so he worked three jobs and moved us out of public housing, bought a house in a white neighborhood across the street from a shopping center that they moved at night to the east side of town where African Americans could live. My father lives in that house this morning, that same house. And his yard is annually recognized as one of the top 10 yards in town. And he is a he's 94. He probably right now he's at work. He cuts the lawns on four houses, and does work on his rental properties. And a couple of years ago, three years ago, I guess he and my wife, his daughter-in-law, Diane, they jump on a bicycle and ride 3 miles. And that's, I'm explaining that the on the male side, they live a long time, and they end up, receiving this great blessing. Didn't come into politics with some kind of a great advantage. In fact, when I declared for mayor, I had one big secret supporter, and in the business community, an attorney named Harold Fricken, who some of you will remember, and another guy, Bill Worley. And no money. Ewan Kaufman, I never could talk about this until after he died, but Ewan Kaufman, who kind of adopted me early on, raised money. And when I was elected in 91 as mayor, the reporting laws weren't the same as they are today. And he said to me one time, he said, somebody's gonna bring you some checks. He brought a little brown bag packed with checks. And I just said, okay, you go deposit it. This is for you to run. And he was with me almost any time something happened, he was right there with me. But I had no advantages in running, except that I was fortunate to come out of a family of people who insisted on us doing the right thing. Now, when they talk about voter ID, it's not some little discussion that I can listen to or hear dispassionately. My grandpa, Noah Albert, lived to be 103 and never voted one time. A part of the time he couldn't vote because he was black. A part of the time in Texas was because he refused to pay $1.50 to vote. And so, when I hear about people passing laws, and in my home state of Texas, the courts just 2 days ago said the state had to redo their voting laws. He found it that they were discriminatory against African Americans and Latinos. Friends, this is the United States. And so I'm serious about this stuff. I mean, there's no game, political game and all of this. I'm not into that. I'm into trying to do things that's going to actually help this country. And so when I went to Washington to run for this, ran for the seat and was elected and went on to Washington, I had been warned by Ike Skelton, my big brother, who I love. He was one of the most important people to me. I was there when his first wife died. I actually did her funeral. And then I did his marriage when he remarried almost 4 years later with the reception in our home. And then with excruciating pain, I buried Ike 2 years ago. And he had warned me about a lot of things, and I thought, Ike, you know, he's kind of trying. He said, look, there are going to be some people who won't even speak to you. And I said, why? And he said, what are you talking about? And he said, look, you have not seen polarization like you're getting ready to see. And I still thought Ike was kind of, you know, trying to scare me up a little. And so I saw it and felt it. And the political tribalism in Washington is at a level that ought to cause every American to tremble. And the last thing we need is for it to get any worse. Compromise does not mean capitulation. Democracy demands compromise. This is no country if we can't compromise. Look, I wanted a public option. The president, I thought he made some mistakes in the negotiations with somebody who wasn't going to vote for it anyway. I grew up in public housing, so you don't negotiate with people and give them something, and then they turn against you. And so the president made a deal with Grassley. He took out the public option, and Grassley voted against it, as we knew he would. And so I had to make a decision. Am I going to vote for this? Although I wanted a public option, I had to think about it approximately 3/10 of a second. I mean, just think what happened if all of us who believed in the public option had said, well, this is not, we're not going to compromise. 20 million people would not have insurance today. Compromise must be a part of the political process.
Yes.
I got a bill approved. I think hopefully the president signed it. We'll sign it tomorrow. I think that's the last day. The most comprehensive change in HUD since it has existed. And I worked with a guy named Blaine Lucdemeyer, a Republican. I mean, we worked on this bill. I mean, I had Democrats mad, and it was tough. We went from Washington to Sweden to Germany to London and back home, and we're on a plane, you know, trying to finish this bill, which we did. The first bill approved by the House with a unanimous vote since 2010.
Wow.
And it got out of the Senate last week. I think tomorrow's the last day the president has to, before he can sign, I mean, before it's a pocket veto, but he's not gonna veto it because it passed the Senate unanimously. Senator Sanders was one of the Senate sponsors. So why am I telling you this? Look, I'm a Democrat. Now, almost every African-American in the United States was a Republican. Probably 99% of all African-Americans were Republican until FDR. And we flipped over. And not going back. Abraham Lincoln, in case you didn't get it. I'm a Democrat, make no mistake about it. I believe in democratic principles. My voting record is 100% with labor.
Yeah.
And all of the democratic organizations, I mean, all of them. So, I mean, I took teasing last week when Paul Ryan did his rollout, and as he's talking and responding, they said, well, you know, what about things going on? He said, well, you know, I just got to say, I enjoy working with the great congressman from Missouri, Emanuel Cleaver. Well, I'm thinking I can't go back to the Capitol, and I took it. I went to the Democratic Caucus meeting, and I walked in. And I knew it. I knew what was going to happen. Get the Republican out of here. Get him out. And I took a lot of teasing, but the truth of the matter is, I don't agree with Paul Ryan on much. I will work with him. I went to John Boehner and said, Mr. Speaker, along with Congressman Al Green, who's here, and said, Mr. Speaker, we got to get some kind of body camera legislation. And to our surprise, he said, you know, I believe in body cameras. I'm glad you guys came and talked to me. I mean, both of us are rocking now because we, you know, we don't. And he sent us to talk to Congressman Goodlatte. 4 months later, we get $20 million, $25 million for body cameras. That's not a lot of money in the United States. But that's a good start. That's a good start. I mean, and the point again here is working with people. Working with people. You don't have to abandon who you are. I mean, I'm going to be me. They got to take me with my strong Democratic voting record, and I'm going to work with them. But I'm not going to call them nasty names. I'm not going to talk about their children. And I'm not going to question their religion.
Right.
I mean, in Washington, the new theory is, you know, you say, I'm right and you're evil. And look, God will not be pimped. And God is God all by himself and doesn't need anybody else's help. And so, you know, I think, you know, people, I mean, this is one of the worst things that's happened in Washington. I mean, you know, people walk around, you know, I'm holier. You know, my name is Jesus Jr. I mean, we need to stop that. You see, a lot of times the voice of God we hear is our own voice in disguise. And so we got to be very, very careful about doing things. I mean, you know, chapter 25 of the Gospel according to Matthew lays out clearly that we ought to take care of the poor, the hurt, the wounded, the widows. It's clear. And I know it's clear, but I don't go down on the floor and say, well, would you please turn to the gospel according to Luke? You know, you don't do that. You don't do that. You stand up and make your case. Now, everybody is who they are based on what they've experienced. And so, I mean, I have an experience, but I don't have to come out and say, you know, this is what God wants me to do. I make my case. That's why I can get along with those guys. I make my case. I don't have to use anything else. Now let me just say this, and I'm through. This election is extremely important, and we don't vote in the off years. I mean, there's something in the Democratic DNA that just tells us, well, you did good a few years ago. Now mess it up. Do you understand that 3.5 years ago, African Americans outvoted whites for the first time percentage-wise in the history of this country? And then 2 years later, I think 6 African Americans voted nationwide with a bunch of white folks. And so we can't continue to do this, and we got to vote. We've got to vote. Yes, yes. Now, you know, I know Hillary Clinton. I have known the Clintons for a long time. And somebody was asking me, I was in Gary, Indiana, campaigning for Secretary Clinton, and somebody asked me, one of the reporters said, what is she like? And I explained to him, I said, look, for the last 25 years, systematically, the Republicans have demonized her to the point where people will say, well, I don't trust her. And then you say, well, can you do the details? Right. And well. And I said, one of the amazing things, if I want to explain Secretary Clinton, is that she is one of the warmest people I've ever been around in my life. And a good, strong Methodist, anybody Methodist in here? United Methodist Women, as you know, she's active with the United Methodist Women and has been, used to be a Sunday school superintendent at the Methodist Church that she grew up in. But there's on these mattresses, you know, the United States, we need help. I go, you know, you make up your bed, and there's a little tag on it that says, do not use if detached. So if the sign's not there, how do you know? And here you are getting ready to go to federal prison because the tag is not there. But the point is, y'all, now work with me. Here's the point. No candidate is good if they are detached. None. And I have seen her in situations. I was with her, driven by Stephanie Tubbs Jones, Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones, to her house in Washington. Michael Eric Dyson, who was here yesterday, his wife Marcia, we all went over there that night. And I was thinking about this the other day. When I got in the car with Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones, we drove from the Methodist building where I live all the way to the house, and it didn't occur to me. We never said a single word to each other, because we knew what was going on. So we get in the backyard, you know, the drinks and everything, and so finally Senator Clinton comes out and she says, I want to just tell you guys I love you, and you know, you've been great. And she said, but I am now getting ready to announce that I am going to suspend my campaign, and I will be voting for Senator Obama. And so there were some hisses. No. She said, no, shh, no, don't do that. She said, don't you do that. She said, we're gonna go out and support Senator Obama. That's what we do.
That's right.
And she said, we're gonna help him become the President of the United States, the first African American to do that. And I listened to people up on the stage talking, many of whom knew the secretary saying that what she said. I was there in the backyard with witnesses. And I saw and heard what kind of person she was when nobody was around. You know what she could have done, and it wouldn't have leaked because of the crowd that was there? She could have said, you know, I don't think he's a good candidate, but we're going to have to support him. He's horrible. She didn't say any of that. In the backyard with friends. And so I've thought about that over and over and over and over again. I could go on about things. I'm going to tell you this one about Martin Luther King III, and I'm going to go back and sit over here on the other side of Claire's sister. Here's Martin Luther King III. Flies into Little Rock, Arkansas in the 80s to do a speech. He gets out of the plane in Little Rock, and he's looking around for his driver. And finally, this blonde woman walks up to him and said, Mr. King, I'm here to pick you up. And he said, oh, okay. She said, I'm Hillary Clinton. He said, the first lady? And she said, yeah, but where are your bags? I mean, he's standing there, you know, rocking. She picks him up from the airport, drives him to the hotel, and then tells him she's going to pick him up at 6:30 or whenever to take him to where he was going to speak. The first lady of the state. No Arkansas highway patrolman or just her. And so you don't hear those kinds of stories. And I thought it would be important for my peoples to know this. But we are a party, and the reason I'm a Democrat, we are a party that brings people in. You heard me stumble earlier over, I said I have 6 first cousins, and then I amended it and said 7. Well, the 7th was named Gary Emanuel Cleaver. It's named after his father, Emmanuel Cleaver, my father's youngest brother, who I was named after, for whom I was named. And Gary, we call him Gary, too many Emmanuels in our family. I'm serious, there's a truckload even now. So Gary, we grew up together. Gary was, you know, a kid, and I, you know, that's all I knew is that he was my cousin, my first cousin. And my first fight was when a little boy across the street called Gary a sissy. Had no idea what he was talking about. It just sounded bad. I said, man, you're not going to talk to my cousin like this. My first fight. All I know, this is my cousin. This is Gary. This is like my family. We, you know, we all grew up together. We lived together. And so Gary leaves and goes to California. And we don't see him for 20 years. Nobody in our family. And then he shows up at a family reunion. Everybody's just excited about seeing him. Then he goes back to California. And then one of my cousins in Dallas called and said, bad news, Gary just died. What? And she said, yeah, they've called and notified me. Well, what's going on? She said, Gary just died of AIDS. And then we start piecing things together. He was a member of the First AME Church in Los Angeles, famous church where he prayed for at night for O.J. Simpson, and the pastor there is a legendary Methodist preacher. He's no longer the pastor. Gary is dead. All of us had to go to church. We had to go to church. You know, all this stuff. Well, my children will make the decision when they get older. We had to go to church, and if we went to hear our grandfather preach, we had to sit up on the front. Grandpa had a cane, and he had it right by the pulpit. So we didn't play. No, go to church. He joins the choir, the male choir, and then a group of the men went to Skip Murray, the pastor, Reverend Skip Murray, and said, the men are going to quit singing unless you can get Cleaver out of the choir. So, well, why is it? Because he has AIDS, and we don't want to catch AIDS. My cousin finds out what happened. He goes over into South Central Los Angeles, finds an abandoned house. Goes into the house and dies alone. He wrote little notes for us. And then left a note that he wanted to be cremated. He didn't feel worthy to go to church. Thank you.